Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Laveau. This week we celebrate Martin Luther King Day, a relative newcomer to our calendar of civic holidays. Our guest will be Matthew Dennis, and our conversation will be about the origins and evolution of the holiday he describes as a protean public festival. After that, Talking History's Fiona Beatty, in another of her Sites of the Week, tells us where we can learn more about Martin Luther King, and Jonathan Zimmerman warns us about the dangers of teaching our children feel-good history. But first, let's take a look at an item of historical interest in the news. A recent news article out of Newport, Rhode Island, reported on a little-known common burying ground containing the remains of those who helped build Colonial Newport, African slaves and their descendants. The 282 gravestones, most dating to the 18th century, form a collection some historians call unparalleled, in that they provide a window into the work, faith, and families of the period. For Keith Stokes, executive director of the Newport County Chamber of Commerce, the head and footstones are also a reminder that Americans of African descent have deep roots in the United States and in the history of Newport, a summer resort and sailing community now best known for its Gilded Age mansions. Historians say the Newport Burying Ground, which came to be known as God's Little Acre, stands out for its size and for how well it's been preserved. It's among the oldest known African burial grounds in the country, and it also contains what may be the first African artwork in the New World, headstones carved by Zingo Stevens, a slave later freed who worked in the stone shop of John Stevens, Jr. Zingo Stevens carved several headstones with cherubs with curly hair and distinctly African features, a pattern repeated throughout the cemetery. Many of the stones recorded the African names of the deceased, the retention of which Jim Garman, a professor of historic preservation at Salve Regina University in Newport, notes, is highly unusual and reflective of the unique circumstances of slavery in that city. Here there is more of an open celebration, or at least toleration, of African culture and history, Garman explains, which may have been due to the urban setting and economy, wherein slaves received comparatively greater education in the trades and crafts. Rhode Island was deeply involved in the slave trade, making it home to more slaves than any of the other northeastern colonies during the colonial period. But it was also the home of Quakers and other religious minorities that led the abolitionist movement at the end of the colonial period, one result of which was one of the largest populations of free African Americans in the new nation. Rhode Island began to abolish slavery in 1784. Yet to come, Matthew Dennis and I discuss Martin Luther King Day. Fiona Beatty tells us about some historic sites associated with King, and Jonathan Zimmerman comments on what he calls feel-good history. You're listening to Talking History. This week's interview is the first in a series that will take us through the calendar year, focusing on American holidays. Our guest for all of these programs will be Matthew Dennis, professor of history at the University of Oregon and the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, an American Calendar, published by Cornell University Press. In the future, we'll be looking at President's Day, Memorial Day, Independence Day, Labor Day, Columbus Day, and Thanksgiving. But this week, we celebrate Martin Luther King Day, the youngest of American public holidays. Welcome, Matthew.
Good to be with you, Brian.
Many Americans dismiss public holidays as merely opportunities to take a day off from work, to relax, or maybe get together with family for dinner or a cookout. But it's clear from your book that you find them important to the United States as a nation and really to us as a people. Why is that?
Well, first, there's nothing wrong with a day off. And of course, you know, a great part of our calendar is the weekend that Americans fought hard to carve out and find a little bit of leisure. And so that celebration of leisure is important. But I'm particularly interested in the ways that holidays set aside time, not just for leisure, but for reflection, historical reflection, as well as some cultural and political work. They stimulate us to think about American identity and history. And holidays are key moments. When we think about history, we form a kind of popular historical consciousness about who we are, how we became who we are. And there are times when Americans reinforce their values, their opportunities for pointing out when Americans have failed to realize those values and to critique American society and to push for reform.
Now, this is particularly important, as you mentioned in your book, because we're such a diverse people. Does that make us different in that regard to other countries that have holidays?
Well, I think what we do is we try to, you know, work through our diversity. And some of those holidays, what they're really trying to do is bring those diverse elements together. You know, the American civic holidays are very much about nationalism, but what that will be is complicated. There's other parts of the world that struggle with some of the same issues, and I wouldn't want to try to make the case for American exceptionalism. But what I focus on in my work is very much how it is that Americans have tried to understand who they were, and it often was, as an exceptional people. Whether that's true or not, I think, is a different issue.
Okay. You mentioned American civic holidays, and you write about the creation of an American civic calendar. What is that? Where do I get a copy?
Yeah. Well, we live it all the time, and it's been growing since the very beginning of the national history. You know, we start out in American history with two key holidays, the 4th of July, Independence Day, and Washington's birthday, which were symmetrically placed in the calendar in the second and seventh months. and were really about the ways that Americans were commemorating or even celebrating themselves into existence. And for the first several decades, those were the only holidays, really national holidays, civic holidays that were in our calendar. But in the second half of the 19th century, we see the emergence of two more that have real national significance. The emergence of Thanksgiving, which grew from kind of localized festival into a national one, officially a national holiday by the 1860s when Abraham Lincoln proclaimed it. And then Memorial Day, which came after the Civil War, and it was an American attempt to make sense of that really devastating conflict. But then by the end of the 19th century, we see things getting even more complicated and diverse, as America itself was getting more complicated and diverse and chaotic and troubling to some. We see the emergence of a Labor Day, of a Columbus Day, and Lincoln's birthday. And so the calendar became more crowded and conflicted, less symmetrical. In a way, it became denser with all those additional days, but in other ways, it became lighter because we see that not all those holidays were celebrated equally with the same fervor in different places across the country. And they began to assume increasingly a more recreational kind of content. They became commercialized and, again, kind of more cacophonous, approach to American celebration.
Okay, well, we're going to talk about all of those over the course of the next year, but let's talk about Martin Luther King Day, because that's the baby of the crowd here, the most recent. Now, King was assassinated April 4th, 1968, and 15 years later, in 1983, President Ronald Reagan signed into law a measure that made the third Monday in January a national holiday in King's honor. Now, that's the short story. Take us back to the time that he was assassinated and remind us how King was viewed at the time of his assassination and maybe what effect his murder had on his reputation.
When Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, it was, a national crisis, and the country was thrown into a state of despair and fear and anger and violence, and there were riots in hundreds of cities across the country. 46 deaths were reported nationally, over 27,000 arrests. So some Americans immediately saw King, his life, and what he symbolized as a potential solution to some of the broader turmoil most immediately felt then and more broadly in American society. And so the symbolism of King almost immediately kind of inspired people to advocate at least a holiday in his honor. Ironically, at the time of his assassination, King was a figure in a way in decline. Not that he was declining in what he was trying to do, but his reputation had declined a bit from maybe his highest moment when he got the Nobel Peace Prize. In a poll, a Gallup poll in 1967, the year before his assassination, he didn't even make the Gallup poll's list of 10 most popular Americans. And he was increasingly a controversial figure. He was grappling with more difficult issues. Once he was assassinated, it was a shock to the American system. And we see this kind of spontaneous vernacular commemoration of King emerging immediately, and that would ultimately grow over a fairly quick period into an official holiday emerging for the first time in 1986, after legislation was signed by Reagan in 1983.
Okay, but it wasn't that smooth, was it? You write in your book that there was some opposition, and this may have made him a hero, and it may have been intended to bring calm to the nation, a very divided nation, but there was opposition. Where was that opposition and why?
Well, absolutely there was opposition, and one of the things about American holidays, and they're part of tradition, tradition is not supposed to have any origin. It just always is. But when you create something, when you invent a tradition, there's a transparency to it. And so all these difficult issues have to be resolved, and they're still being resolved with regard to King and this day. There were plenty around who still were really bucking the sorts of things he was advocating. He was a figure not universally loved by those who were resisting civil rights, for example, or his efforts to fight the Vietnam War or to advocate for poor people in the United States. There was immediate opposition. It usually took two forms, and they actually overlapped somewhat. One was that to throw another paid holiday into the calendar was economically imprudent. And the second was that while we could celebrate his causes, he himself somehow was not of a reasonable stature to have his own holiday. He wasn't a Washington or a Lincoln, say. So these could work together in some ways to try to resist this push towards a new national holiday.
Okay, but the resistance failed and the movement succeeded. We had a holiday. And you write, and I found this very interesting, that although many people think 15 years is a long time to create the holiday, when you look at it historically, it really was a fast track. So maybe you better explain that a bit.
Well, you know, it was a whirlwind. Martin Luther King Jr.'s public career was only, you know, if you calculate it, really, it was only about 13 years. And in just over that amount of time, we see a holiday emerge in his honor. A holiday, say like Thanksgiving, was a kind of vernacular festival that emerged over a long period of time and took a long time to place itself into the kind of the heart of the American calendar and the American people. People say history's accelerated in the 20th and 21st century, and it seems like the case. I mean, the turmoil and the tumult of the 1960s and all that entails had a really revolutionary impact on American society. And so, you know, King symbolized much of that, represented much of that. So if we look at the beginning, there was a grassroots effort to create the King holiday. In many ways, then, politicians, some of whom were quite sincere in trying to promote Martin Luther King Jr. Day, others would have seen this as a trend worth getting in front of. So for various reasons, then, it emerged pretty quickly, first at the state level and then nationally. And King, once he was enshrined in that holiday, then could become a malleable figure, especially since his death, when he couldn't contradict, you know, the causes with which he was being associated, made him a kind of potent resource, even for those who didn't support him during his life and who would seem to contradict some of the things that are more kind of plausibly predicted that he would have done if he had lived longer.
The speed with which this came about, let me just dwell on that a minute longer. Would this have affected what you write about and others have noticed, that we know what Independence Day is about? We know what Thanksgiving is supposed to represent. People aren't so clear about Martin Luther King Day.
Right, that's true. And what we see is a kind of competing notions. For a holiday to work, I think, in American cultural life, it has to have a kind of universal appeal. It has to represent some kind of a national goal. Yet it also has to have a kind of particularism. It has to have a kind of constituency if it's going to be vital. And so with regard to King, we see him universally represent equality and civil rights. But he's also an exemplary African American. And so he represents a hero to Black Americans in particular. He's an American, but he's also an African American. And there can be a strain between those two things. Is it an American holiday? Is it an African-American holiday? And many advocates of the holiday would say, well, absolutely, it's both. But in some cases, there's a strain between those two things.
Okay, well, we only have a minute left, but does that relate to why you write in your book calling it the King Day a protean public festival or a work in progress?
It's definitely a work in progress, as all holidays are, but it's not clear yet where that will go. In some ways, the sign of its real arrival, its establishment, is its commercialization, or people, you know, almost deciding that it's not controversial. On the other hand, the ongoing controversy associated with it will give it meaning and push people to really articulate what King was about and why he's an important American hero.
I think that's right. Well put. Okay, well, we'll end it there, but thank you, Matt, for joining us.
It's good to talk to you, Brian.
Okay, we look forward to speaking to you sometime soon, in February, I guess, about President's Day.
Great.
You've been listening to Matthew Dennis, professor of history at the University of Oregon and the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, An American Calendar, published by Cornell University Press. This is Talking History. Bye. Martin Luther King spent several years of his life in Atlanta, Georgia. Fiona Beatty went in search of that city's sites associated with King, which you might visit to learn more about the man whose birth we celebrate this week.
Sweet Auburn, a name evocative of Victorian gentility and the residential area that was home to Martin Luther King in Atlanta, Georgia. Born on January the 15th, 1929 at 501 Auburn Avenue, King spent 12 formative years in this pleasant two-story Victorian home with his family and their boarders. Ebenezer Baptist Church, open to the public and the former pastorate of both his grandfather and father, and eventually Martin Luther King himself, lies two blocks away. Now a National Historic Site, managed by the National Park Service, the visitor can glimpse into the past and discover the home, neighborhood, and church where King grew up. And only a mouse click away is a virtual tour of the King home on Auburn Avenue. Visit the kitchen where King spent many hours chatting to his grandmother while she cooked for the family, or the dining room where the family ate, talked, and discussed life. A brief script provides information about every room, its occupants, and life as it was when the King family lived there. If you visit in person, stroll along the 1.5-mile King Carter Peace Walk that connects the Martin Luther King home to the Carter Presidential Library. And just up the road at 449 Auburn Avenue is the King Center, founded by Coretta Scott King and home to the King Center Library, archives, and more. To plan your visit and to find out more, go to www.nps.gov/MALU.
Just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the diesel coming. You don't need no ticket, no, no. You just thank the Lord.
And finally, as promised, Jonathan Zimmerman takes on how history is often taught in the schools, an example of which he finds in what grade school students are often taught about African American history. Zimmerman is a professor of education and history at New York University.
17 years ago, as a young social studies teacher in Baltimore, I led a class of sixth graders through a lesson on the Civil Rights Movement. We had just reached the 1963 March on Washington, when one of the students asked a question that I hadn't expected. "Is it true," she asked, "that Martin Luther King cheated on his wife?" "Yes," I replied, and then I explained how we knew it was true. The Federal Bureau of Investigation wiretapped King's hotel rooms. The next day, I received a call from an irate African-American parent. "My daughter's feeling very upset," the parent said. "You've taken away her hero, her role model." Several other black parents called the principal, who summoned me to his office for a stern warning: "Stick to the textbook, or else." Suffice to say that the textbook didn't have anything bad to say about Martin Luther King or about anyone, really. The book presented Americans in all of their wondrous diversity, highlighting the contributions of notable minorities to politics, literature, athletics, and the arts. But each group in society, like each color of the rainbow, remained pure and immaculate. Why do schools teach history as a pageant of diverse heroes and role models, a multicultural hall of fame? The trend reflects America's post-war embrace of psychology, which you can hear on any daytime talk show. And you can also hear it in Brown v. Board of Education, the landmark decision that the Supreme Court handed down 50 years ago this past spring. According to Brown, segregating African-American children generates a feeling of inferiority that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone. In other words, segregation is wrong because it hurts black self-esteem. By the 1960s, African Americans and their liberal white allies would use the same rationale for revising America's history textbooks. Black kids needed to see themselves in the books, or their self-esteem would suffer. Up until this time, most American history books denigrated or ignored African Americans. Now the textbooks allowed famous blacks like Martin Luther King. That's good news for all of us. But the gains came at a cost. For whenever a new racial hero moved into our textbooks, he, or increasingly she, also moved beyond reproach. So textbooks depicted the evils of slavery, but rarely mentioned that Africans practiced it themselves. They tempered their descriptions of Indian massacres by the Spanish conquistadors, lest Hispanic students take offense. In the process, an honest and complex history became impossible. Nothing in history is purely good or purely bad, not even Brown versus Board of Education.
You've been listening to Jonathan Zimmerman, Professor of Education and History at New York University and the author of Who's America? Culture Wars in the Public Schools, published by Harvard University Press. Zimmerman's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. That's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Fiona Beatty, producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. The opinions offered by our guests on Talking History, however, do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And as always, we invite you to send us your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.